Hey everyone, on today's podcast, I've got my friend, goalie coach, confidant, mentor, Chris Economo. We date back 19 years when we first started skating together. We were lucky enough to be hooked up by Mitch Korn after I was drafted by the Nashville Predators in 2002, and Econ's been one of the most important people in my life ever since. He's molded my game, we've had a ton of fun, and he's got a great outlook on the position and everything that goes into it. So, hope you enjoy. It's a wide-ranging interview. Chris Economo. Let's go back a little bit in our relationship. I mean, we've been on the ice now for, did we figure out 18 years?
It could be 16 to 19. We can't figure it out, but it's been since what was the date?
So 2002, I was drafted by the Predators, and we have a mutual friend.
Yeah,
his name happens to be Mitch Korn.
Mm-hmm.
Mitch told me that I'm a big man who can't skate, but I got a guy who's going to fix that. So I'm sending you to see Chris Economo in Buffalo, New York.
Yeah.
So it's 2002.
So, yeah, I ran a pro camp at that time, and we called it a pro camp. It was basically an invite camp,
yeah,
guys that I wanted to train, and it was mostly about skating, and it was a skating camp. So the skating camp was, like it's announced, skating only.
We didn't touch a puck.
Not a puck.
No, it was a full week.
No
pucks.
It was almost 2 weeks.
2 weeks, was, right? We did take a break.
It was 2 weeks with a day off of riding roller coasters,
right.
I think.
We did. We'd always find a park to go to. Like, we went to Darien Lake that first year, yeah.
Yeah, so it was two sessions a day of skating. So we would skate in the morning for about an hour and 15 minutes, and then we would skate, like, in the afternoon for, like, an hour and a half. And it was all edge work. Complete movement drills, combinations, saves, up and down the ice, and it's basically torture. I mean,
how old were you when you started doing this camp? Because when I got there, I mean, it's hard to believe now, but you were 30.
Yeah. So I'd have to go back a little bit to tell you how it evolved, but the short version of that is probably I ran my first skating camp. And I couldn't even give you the year, but it was in the late 90s. And it was in Pittsburgh, and I was living in Buffalo. So every Monday night, I would drive to Pittsburgh, and I had six goalies, the very first one. And it was a very difficult decision to make because I thought I was going to get more kids for it, so it was an absolute break-even / I lost money going to Pittsburgh every Monday night. But I decided to do it. And at the time, no one was about the skating. And everyone thought that I was crazy for doing it. And I said, well, I'm going to run a camp that is just based on skating and movement and saves. And I thought it was similar to, like, golf. You could practice your golf swing without hitting a golf ball. So you really didn't need shooters. And I didn't know if it would be successful or not, but I was going to try it regardless. And we'll probably talk about what I did later. But the reason I started this, back when I left the game for a while, and when I came back to the game, I was practicing to get back into it, and I couldn't get shooters because the only ice time I could get was like 6 in the morning.
So you were just out there bagging yourself without any pucks.
Without any pucks, yeah. By myself. And over time, I had to, like, create these drills. And I was still coaching at the time with Mitch Korn.
But you weren't playing.
But I wasn't playing. Right. I left the game for a couple of years. And so I had to go out in the morning, and I said, okay, how am I going to get better? So I would practice. Next thing you knew, I had like 200, 300 skating drills. So when I rolled this thing out, like, people thought I was crazy.
Yeah,
absolutely crazy. Like, this is total bullshit that this guy is doing this. No one, this is ridiculous. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to go with it. So I end up doing this camp, and you had to find different ways of doing the same things over and over again. Because realistically, as a goalie, you're only doing like three or four things. Your team, you're shuffling, you're making saves.
Yeah, it's going to get crazy monotonous if you don't find over some different
over.
Ways to
and
do
yeah,
it.
And yeah, and the goalie guys will tell you now, yeah, we build muscle memory and this is what we do.
Yeah.
But for the kids, you had to find a way to make it fun.
Yeah, and you had to find a way to teach them to work outside the box too,
yeah,
right? Like you
absolutely.
Can't just do a T-push within your crease.
Mm-hmm.
Like when we first started together, we did stuff up and down the ice.
Yeah, so I tried to incorporate like I thought about like how power skating for forwards was different than goalies and how can we make it similar. And I came up with like lanes and we would go up and down the ice. And it's not realistic to shuffle laterally back and forth all the way up and down the ice, but it does create muscle memory.
Power,
man. Control, discipline, and all yeah. those things that you want as a goalie. And I thought that this would be cool. And I all I wanted to do was fill like an hour and a half of ice and then see how it goes. So that was the very first one in Pittsburgh. And it was successful in a way that the people that actually stayed and did it loved it, right?
Yeah. And I'm sure it's because they were seeing results right away.
Yeah,
when you train that intensely for that much time and overtrain like we were doing for that amount of it, you're going to see results right away in your skating.
And
for sure. I'm a prime example
yeah.
of that because I couldn't skate when I first got to you.
Yeah. So a little footnote with that camp. One of the kids that was in it is Parker Milner. So it's the first time I ever met Parker Milner.
NCAA national champion. Who, by the way, here, his pads are on the wall
yeah.
in the Goalie Guru offices yep. here. We've got a whole wall of fame sitting up there.
Yeah.
I'm honored that I've got a couple pads up there.
It's amazing. It's my prize collection.
Yeah. So how old was Parker then?
He was like 10 years old.
Yeah.
And again, I mean, Parker was this little kid before puberty and yeah. you know, he didn't realize that he could be who he is now at that time.
Right.
But he was there every week and he went through it and it was, I honestly, I'm so mad at myself for not remembering the name of the rink. I'll probably think of it halfway through our talk here. But it's very similar to the rink that I train in right now. It was a small studio rink in Pittsburgh. And
so like a mini rink,
it's
right?
a mini, like absolute
rink you,
mini
the
rink.
The rink that you have out here behind where we're sitting right now is essentially a mini rink that's about the size from the blue line in it or so. Turn it sideways, put a couple nets at each end.
Yeah.
So not big, things happen really quick.
Mm-hmm.
But it's good for training though because you can do things in a confined area that still has a bit of flow to it. But you can also dial it back and do little stations when you need to. So
yeah.
It's perfect size.
So the size of the rink for me, especially training with shots now, it enables the goalie to learn how to make combinations. So one of my beliefs is like, it's not good enough to stop shots. You have to have the ability to make a save in control. Because anyone can put on gear and make a save. But if you make a save in control, you have the ability to move and make two or three saves. So your ability to make two and three separates you from the person who is just standing there that looks like an absolute donkey in the cage. That yeah, he stopped a puck, but you can tell that he can't really play.
Yeah, and it's not even just setting up for a second or third save. It's also your ability to control that first. You know, the
yeah.
more control you are of your body, the better chance you have of being able to eat that puck or
yeah.
put it where you want, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So
just to finish up on the skating, the skating camp evolved from there to, oh my God, let's take the crew of guys that I know and just offer it to them. And I recruited people that I wanted to train, that I knew, like college guys at the time and guys who were in Mitch Korn's network. And we just said, okay, let's put it together for everyone. And then that's where Mitch sent you and said, okay, you're a part of that. And that's how it evolved to you.
So let's take this back kind of the start of everything before we even get into the camps you're doing and have done ever since. grew up in Buffalo, played there, mm-hmm. ended up going on. You played at Buff State, played a little bit in Roller Hockey International. Tell us about your journey through the sport as a youth player. God. And especially your junior times, too.
Oh, for sure. I mean, the story is long. We probably need like 5 hours to really tell the story. But
how did you end up being a goalie? How about that?
So, okay.
Sparked it for you?
So I wanted to be, I guess my mom tells the story even to this day that when I was like 3 years old, I was on the sidewalk and I was wearing like a clown mask and I tied like little foam pads and I was out there playing goal. And just a stick, and I have no idea. I don't remember it, but I wanted to do it back then. And in Buffalo, the town of Tonawanda, we had two rinks, Brighton Arena and Lincoln Arena. And both of them at the time were open rinks. So, I mean, there was nothing there. And right. And my dad would take us there, and we learned to skate. So we were doing the Learn to Skate program and just tooling around. And we figured that, okay, look at those guys are playing hockey. When can we do it? So we jumped into a beginner program or whatever they had rolling there. And they had an in-house / junk league that was, okay, we'll take anyone and here you go.
Take right? every pigeon out yeah, there. Put them in.
Yeah, boys. Just, yeah. We're just going to teach
yeah.
kids.
Yeah.
So I get out there and I'm a forward. And I mean, I didn't really like it. And I'm looking at the goalie and I'm thinking, that's what I want to do. And there was another kid that was our goalie at the time, and he didn't show up the one day. And the coach said, hey, his name was Dick Miskowitz.
No.
Dick Miskowitz.
That's an unbelievable name.
It is. It's great. and Dick said we need a goalie.
I might look him up.
Yeah.
I'd like to send him a Christmas card.
Yeah. And he goes, yeah, anyone want to play? And I was like, yeah, I'll put the stuff on. And then from there, I did it once. And then for that the rest of that year, I did a half and half. So I would play the first half of the games as a forward. Halfway through the game, I'd run off the ice, and with my shin pads on, I'd put on goalie pads over the shin pads.
Come on.
Over the shin pads. It was embarrassing. And the gear is absolutely terrible. The gear is absolutely terrible.
What year do you think this was?
1979.
So what were you wearing for facial protection?
So I had as a forward, which is terrible, I had the SKA 600 Cooper, which is the square helmet that Michigan wore when he got scored on by Arruzioni.
Yeah.
And then basically the same setup as that.
Gotcha. So you never wore the full face Jason style Eddie Cheever's
no,
mask?
No. I was the first year that I played was the first year that there was HEC approved type.
Gotcha.
Masks.
And your pads were all just straight brown, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Do you even remember like the company they were?
They were Coopers. They were Coopers that I wore. And
two-piece arm and chest.
Two-piece arm and chest. It looked like a baseball chest protector. And you had the shoulder arm pads that were like felt that you were wearing. And there were two pockets. There was a pocket below your elbow and a pocket above your elbow, and you just filled them with pads. So getting pelted was, I mean, there was zero protection. Absolute zero protection.
I take that for granted for today, don't we?
Oh, yeah.
With what we're wearing. I mean, we complain about getting shots off the arms, and every shot you got probably resulted in a big bruise back then.
Big time. Yeah. Even all the way through, even like nowadays, it's funny, you know, you don't need as much courage to play goalie anymore like you did back then.
Were you a vindictive bastard, though, when somebody would hit you?
Later in my career, yeah. Probably early, no, not so much. But later, yeah. Once I got into it, I was a bit of a donkey.
Did you have any heroes as a kid, though? Like, I mean, I'm guessing Sabres were a big...
Well, the Sabres were huge. I mean, so...
Did you latch on to any of their goalies?
Yeah, so to the start was Don Edwards, watching Don Edwards play. And Don Edwards ended up being like the goalie coach for the LA Kings for a while towards his end. But he actually won the Vezina with he won the Vezina, and the and his partner was Bob Sauve. So I'd watch both those guys play.
Play against the sun, yeah.
Yeah. So watching those guys really was when I started. And then Tom Barrasso, when he came in.
18-year-old phenom out of prep school.
And a great story about him. I remember watching Tom Barrasso at Nichols High School in Buffalo playing in a tournament as a high school player. National championship or something that was going on there, and there was this guy who was just incredible. And the next year, he was in Buffalo, so I do remember that. And I do remember him at the very beginning as an 18-year-old coming into the NHL and just being an absolute beast.
Oh, that's unheard of. Pretty much what he did,
making skate saves, big guy, you know. Big, lanky, with barely any gear on, and then opening up and making saves.
Yeah,
as a lefty, is amazing.
Yeah, pretty good puck handler, too.
Oh, yeah.
Something people forgot about him. He was really good at it.
He was one of the first that could actually launch the puck and make good plays.
For sure. I mean, him and Hextall, when you look in the 80s, those were two of the guys that really started to set the trend there, and then obviously it's taken a whole new life of its own since, but... You get through your youth hockey and you make it to juniors. You're in the North American Hockey League. Tell me about that experience, right? Because you're with Niagara there, right?
Yeah. So at the time, it was the Buffalo Junior Sabres. They fell apart, and a guy named Chris Hicks bought the franchise.
Because you were young when you started.
Yeah, too. I was 16 years old when I played in the North American League, and. They were called the Niagara Scenics. We played in the North American League at the very beginning when there were really only six teams. So mostly out of Detroit, Chicago. Well, one out of Chicago, Chicago Young Americans, the Niagara Scenics out of Buffalo, and then there were four teams out of Detroit that we play. So when I played juniors, we would travel to Detroit basically every other weekend. Home one weekend, on the road. And... Yeah, it was pretty crazy. Played against like Doug Waite and guys of that era. So it's been
an absolute circus back then.
It was. It was an absolute gong show. I mean,
when I played in the NA, we'd had the three ring circus going. It seemed like every five or six games, we'd have fights all over the place. So I can only imagine your time there.
Yeah, there were not a lot of rules. There were not a lot of rules with the refs, right? So
they didn't have much of a professional standard, right?
And you know, I think hockey has done a really good job taking away a lot of that stuff, because you really don't want to see guys. I mean, you could kill someone swinging the stick like we used to. Yeah. I mean,
stick fights were a real thing.
A real thing.
That's not even in the vocabulary anymore.
Not anymore. I mean, imagine like chopping a guy nowadays, and you turn around, you're going to get killed.
Yeah.
Back then, it was like, yeah, you're going to get killed, but it was like a normal practice. Right? The guy comes near you, and you just chop him, and you say, like, listen, don't get anywhere near me. So
you had to go, you had to chuck the knucks a few times, right, when you were there?
No, I don't know if I got in a one fight, if you want to call it that. I mean, I was playing in CompuWare, and line brawl broke out, and we were doing pretty well at the time. Like, so if five fights break out, it was the end of the game, and I made it to like center ice. And that was it before two guys jumped off the bench, and I had to fight a defenseman.
So you didn't even get to fight another.
I didn't. No. Like,
you
like,
had to
like,
fight a full-fledged
like,
player.
Full-fledged player. He was like 6 foot. I'm 5'10". Yeah. You know, I thought I'd go down there and kick the crap out of the other goalie, and that would have been fun. You know,
you got to do my thing. I
intercepted completely. You know, I mean, I didn't realize how bad it was until like I was like skating towards the bench when the ref broke it up, and everyone's jaw was dropped on the bench looking at my face.
You look like a meat locker.
I got tooled up pretty good.
Were you bleeding?
Yeah. Oh yeah. And then the worst part about it was I had after the game, I had to like jump on the bus and take a 5-hour ride home back to Buffalo. And I basically had an ice bag on my head the whole time.
So, you play a couple years there, end up at Buff State. That was the next step, right?
Well, not, or did you go through something else too? No, not the like in between there. So one of the things that really sort of screwed me was I didn't do well enough in school, and I didn't honor it well enough, and you know I left the game for a couple of years. So
when did you bow out? Did you still have junior eligibility?
I did. And I wanted to try to hook up with someone, but at the time, back then, you didn't really have agents like they do now. And, you know, I just sort of ran my course, and I was still coaching at the time. And I left the game for a couple of years, so I was just working. So I played 2 years of juniors. I'm 18. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I was like, okay. I left it, and then at 20 years old, I decided that I wanted to play in college, and they said, here you go. And there's lots of stuff in between, but for the college aspect, I went to Buff State and played there for a year and basically fell in the same trap. But I was there, and I played, and I was good enough to play. It's just that I didn't have my shit together in terms of being the whole package, which is now, I mean, I look back at it and go, you know, I'm definitely disappointed in myself in that way. But by going through that, all the guys that go through here now, they don't train here unless they do well in school.
Yeah, everybody knows it's a requisite at this point.
Yeah, at this point, you got to do it.
And you're, so. I mean, you're based in the Philadelphia area now, and do you think most of the kids that come to see you, they're really looking to go to college route?
Well, I mean, that's what we would push. I mean,
yeah.
any kid that can go to college and then anything after that is a bonus as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I mean, for me, too, I look at college and I think, you know, there's no guarantees on anything. And if you're a good prospect, if you go to college and you get 2-3 years, whatever that may be, and you get a chance to go pro afterwards, so be it, right?
Yeah.
You can come back and do your schooling, still finish it off. I mean, to me, major junior is a big jump, and you better be a blue chip prospect if you're taken off as a goalie.
Yeah.
To me, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
So I think that college,
especially as an American, also
exactly right. Like, it's not as ingrained in us that should be our route.
Yeah,
you know, and like I was a Midwestern kid, so I.
Yeah, because you know. I mean, junior up in Canada, they'll say, "Well, we'll pay for college." But you're going to Canadian college, right? So if you live in Canada, it's a different scenario than it is if you live in the U.S. Yeah. Most of those U.S. they bank on the fact that U.S. kids won't take that.
Yeah, if you're a St. Louis kid and you think you're going to get a scholarship to go study at York University in Toronto instead of go to your buddies at Mizzou,
yeah,
I think you know what's going to happen.
Yeah,
you know?
No question.
So, well, going back here, like you talked about how you did coaching, and we just hinted on it real quick, but there was, I think, one person who was kind of a driving force behind this a little bit, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when did your relationship with Mitch Korn start?
So I grew up in Buffalo, New York, and when I started playing, I really knew nothing about the position. All I did was I threw my whole body at the puck, and I would do whatever I could to stop the puck. Whether it was right or wrong, it didn't matter. I was just, like, out there doing what I thought was right. And the network of goalie coaches back then was like 1% of what it is now. And I met Mitch Korn at his first goalie school ever.
Ground floor.
And
what year do you think this was?
So 78, 79, in that range.
It's in Buffalo.
Yeah. And I said to my parents, I'd like to go to a camp. And they found this brochure that Mitch Korn was running a goalie school in Buffalo. So I showed up. And he tells the story that and it was funny because I'll tell you the story in a second, but my parents just dropped me off. I'm 8, 9 years old, right? And they just dropped me off, and and everyone who knows how Mitch is, like, he's how he runs his camps, I mean, he's everything has order, and you show up, you register, you sit through orientation, and then you are told what to do, and this is how we're going to do it, and then it's done to perfection, right?
Yep, that's it.
Right? So I'm 8 years old, and like I didn't know. I just went to the locker room, right, to get dressed, yeah. And he comes in, and he... And
here's the condom.
And they're like, you didn't register!
He says,
I started crying or whatever. I might have, who knows. But he definitely scared the shit out of me, right? And then, so I would go to his camps. And I was only able, like, my dad worked hard his whole life. And, I mean, I couldn't go to, like, camps like the kids do now, like, all summer long or anything. Right. It was basically 5 days of training, and then you had to take that training the rest of the year.
I mean, that's even through me. I mean, with our age difference, we're, you know, whatever.
Yeah, very similar, though, in the way that you had to be good about how you approached what you were going to do to improve yourself all the time in the summer.
Yeah, because the onus was on us.
Yeah.
I mean, you might get 5 days or, if you're lucky, a week with a goalie coach and a goalie camp, but that was an overarching guy who was running all his instructors and doing stations, and it wasn't like the one-on-one stuff that we're able to get nowadays.
Yeah.
Right?
So I went to his camps, and obviously it was amazing. I mean, even back in the day, I mean, it was very organized in a way that he would create situations, and then you would have some idea of how to play. And what he does obviously works, right? So even
you didn't get on his bad side at all at the camps.
I'm sure I did. Sure, I don't know. I mean, I tried really hard for him, but I mean, it's hard to even remember like some of the early things. You remember less and less as you get older. But I do remember like certain things, like you had three guys and you have to be in the net, and then you take five reps and then you get out, and then the next guy goes and you have to be ready to get in, and there wasn't like
you play by the rules
and yeah. you go and you do your thing. So I did that, and then I ended up having, I'm thinking like, how do I get more of this in the summer? So I went a couple summers, and there was an open spot, and he offered an extra week for me, like a spot. And I was like, that's great. You know, I'll take it. So I was there. So I ended up going to the camp for 2 straight weeks.
Yeah, it's in your hometown anyway.
Hometown,
right?
Why not, and I was right? able to do it.
You're young,
there was an open spot, and yeah. I was fortunate enough that he offered it, and I was willing to take it. And at this point, he said to me, he goes, we have a camp in Miami that we do.
Miami, Ohio.
Yep. Miami University.
Yep.
Do you want to come to the camp? I'm like, that would be great. I would love to do that. So that was like the first time I ever got away from home. And I was young. I was like 12, 13 years old. I was 13, well, probably 13 years old. And so I went to that camp. Went through the whole deal there too.
Is that the sleepaway? You stay in the dorms and everything too?
Yeah, you
too?
Stay away. Yeah. It was the first time I've ever gone away by myself. And I end up saying, this is great. That was fun. And at the end, they would ask, hey, do you want to work as a counselor? And it was like slave labor back then. I don't know how much they paid me, but I think it was like $20 per week or whatever it was. But obviously, I want to do it. I'll do whatever I can to get training or be around hockey people and learn. So I end up doing that, and I do that for a couple years. And at like 16 years old, 15, 16 years old, I think it was Mitch's. I'm a counselor. And I'm there for 3 weeks.
At Miami High,
working.
At 16 years old.
Yeah. So you're away for 3 weeks. You go there. And this is way before cell phones. This is way before anything.
You're on a different continent, basically.
Yeah. There's no way of getting hold of me. It's sort of like I am now, but except I you really can't get a hold of me. So I'm there, and I believe it was Mitch's grandmother or grandfather or someone passed away, and he had to go, and he said, hey, do you wanna, can you be a coach? So I'm 16 years old, and can you coach the rest of the week? So now, being a coach there, you have no rules except for showing up for ice time. That's it. So now, before, the counselor rules were like, you work 2/3 of the day. You either work in the morning and the afternoon, or the afternoon and at night, or morning and night. So you'd have certain times off. Being a coach, you just have to show up for the ice, and then you could be whatever. So like, that's where I learned that it was like, this is cool. I like this. I'm really into coaching. I think I want to do this.
Were there any moments you had to bring the hammer down on kids, though?
Going back as a new coach. No, most new coaches, I believe that like you need to gain their respect, and you don't really hammer them as much.
Can you remember Mitch bringing the hammer down on a kid?
Oh, of course. I mean, my God, yeah, absolutely. Mitch, and obviously I have to give huge props to him for how I coach now. I mean, I basically created my coaching philosophy based on him and how he does it. And my whole coaching philosophy is based on balance. Okay, so if I'm in the center, if I take a kid into the bad X amount, at some point I have to give him so much good to bring him back to center. So if you tell a kid he's great, he's great, he's great, eventually he's going to be like, this guy doesn't know shit. Okay, I don't, you're like, why am I here? And if you tell the kid he absolutely sucks and you're not doing it right and you hammer him nonstop, eventually he's going to say, this guy's an asshole, I don't want to work with him. So you have to go back and forth. You need to know the good and the bad, and you have to manage it nonstop. So like, to this day, I still manage every single kid that way, up and down. And again, it's being blunt about what I think and where you take them, up and down all the time.
And that dynamic probably changes as they get older and move on through the game, I'd guess, too, right?
For sure.
So it's especially when they're in their developmental age, right? That really comes
for sure. Point. I mean, think about like coaching. Everyone thinks like that you could just rip a guy and then it would be okay. Imagine ripping like Holtby. I mean, that doesn't happen, you know. But for a 12-year-old that comes to Mitch Korn, of course he can rip him, right? Yeah. Like, of course. Like, again, you either do it this way or not. So everyone earns their respect, right?
Yeah. So you did all those years of coaching there. You started to do your own stuff. I mean, you had some wild times, I'd imagine, on Miami, Ohio campus.
Yeah.
A lot of fun years for you there, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that's where you spent how many years of your – I mean, how many summers did you spend doing it there?
I did it over a decade, and I'm scared to even try to figure out what it was, but I was going there for over a decade while in conjunction with working Mitch's camps on the road.
Right.
So eventually he said, okay, go on the road with me, and I was basically his right-hand guy from day one.
And a lot of that time you were still, I mean, with junior playing, when you made your comeback, trying to play again, getting yourself ready to skate and hopefully do whatever. And in the middle of it all, you got this roller hockey international gig somehow.
Yeah, that was actually pretty funny.
You got to give me the background on it, because this league has a mystique all to its own.
Yeah. So I only played like a couple roller hockey games, and it was when it started, I was like, oh, this looks pretty cool. And one of the guys I was playing against when I was at Buff State, I knew him. He was from Niagara, Canada. And he said to me, he's like, hey, we need a goalie. We need a goalie to come out to St. Louis.
The Vipers.
The Vipers.
Yeah.
And play. and come to
so
camp.
So he did the recruiting for you.
He did. Like, and he said, you can do this. And I said, well, okay, I'll try it. And, I said, well, what kind of skates do I have to wear? He's like, well, you got to figure it out. So I...
Open tryouts. Come on, boys.
Yeah, like, so here you go.
Yeah.
And this is before it exploded. Now you can buy goalie skates.
Things that are purpose built for this stuff.
For
right?
this.
Like, and it was the Wild West.
We did not have it.
Right.
So what I did was I took an old pair of Bauer Supremes that I had with cowlings, and I hacksawed the blade off of a Bauer cowling, white cowling. And then I ended up grabbing a guy and I said, listen, I want these mounted. I want these roller blades.
The chassis or whatever.
The chassis.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Mounted to this goalie skate. And he did it. He drilled holes in it and made it happen. And I was like, okay, this is awesome.
You looked the part.
It looked the part. Yeah, here we go. Exactly. You actually look like you know
you didn't
what the
look
hell
like
you're
an
doing.
Absolute joker with a pair of like rollerblade Phantoms that you bought at Walmart on your feet, right?
No question, right? And I said, okay, this is awesome. So I'm super excited to put them on. I'm ready to go. And I get to the rink, and at the time, that was where it was almost the change of the toe buckles to laces, when guys started to use laces. So I had Vaughns at the time, Vaughn Legacies, like the originals.
Yep.
And I had laces on them, and I said, holy shit, how the hell am I going to get this harnessed to the toe of my skate?
Without it getting jammed up in the wheels and
exactly,
falling over
right?
yourself.
Yeah. Exactly. So I'm like, holy Christ, this is ridiculous. What am I
going
to do?
Innovation going on here.
So like the very first time, I wasn't thinking ahead, and I had no idea. So I cut the laces off, and then I got home, and I'm like, I cannot do this. This is ridiculous.
So you're going to play without any toe lace?
The first time I got on the ice, yes, I did.
On the sport court.
On the sport court. I'm like, right. Oh my God, this is stupid.
Yeah. Pads over rotating like crazy. Yeah. Yeah.
So I decided that I was going to just drill a hole through the front of the chassis, which I did. So I grinded out a hole on each side, and then I had the lace go through like it was the front of the blade. And that worked at the time.
And you made the team.
You played
a couple games, right?
Yeah, so like I was there through the whole thing, and then I sat, and then I was there for like 2 months.
What were they paying guys back then?
I probably lost money.
I mean, was it kind of like comparable to the ECHL, where they were at least like paying housing for guys, and then
It was sort of like the East Coast League, where when the guys first that get there, they're there, but they aren't there. It was one of those scenarios.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So it wasn't like I wasn't doing it to make money. I was doing it to sort of find myself. And it was something to do to fill time. And I didn't really realize what I wanted to do with my life at that point.
So there are some characters involved in this league.
Oh, big time. So the little that I remember, Perry Turnbull was out there.
Yep. I know Perry was a coach. Travis is a friend of mine. Played against him. Yep.
So the mask that I had was like, I was one of the first guys to ever have like a legit goalie mask. And I had a mask made from Wright. And Wright.
Jerry Wright.
Sold. Right? Yeah. He sold it to iTech.
That's right.
And then iTech turned into Bauer.
Right.
So I had this mask, and I put it on out there. Well, in St. Louis, it's friggin' like 110 degrees in the summer. And I got out there, and I got on the ice.
And you're outside.
Outside, inside, didn't matter.
Right.
Like, I wanted to barf in this mask. It was so goddamn hot, right?
Yeah.
So I'm like, how am I going to get around this? I can't wear this. Like, I gotta put something else on. So... I said, okay, I'm going to go back to, like, the Dominic Hasek helmet, which I wore in junior. And I said, well, I can't just wear that helmet.
So you were in the combo in junior?
Yes.
Yeah.
With the old iTech HM30. With I actually had the white neck protector,
the iTech bib, like Jeff Hackett used to wear.
The bib, which was amazing.
I had one, too. I had a clear one.
Which was amazing, right? Yep. So I put this great helmet combo together for roller hockey, and it was the Cooper helmet with the HM30, right?
Yeah.
And the bib.
iTech bib.
And I took the HM30 chin cup out, and I put, like, just a small little chin cup in, so it was mounted out like Van Beesbrouck wore. And the reason I did that was because then the air would actually...
You got some flow.
Yeah. You weren't about to barf every time you did something.
I mean, that's... Obviously, that era comes to a conclusion, but... Yeah. Another cool footnote in your story, though, is you get the call and you end up dressing an American League game for Rochester. Like, how'd that all go down?
Oh, my God. So, during this time, so I played for played and tried out and did all the camps with some Central Hockey League teams at the time.
All the money makers that they
did,
right?
Yeah. And I did I was in Tulsa's camp, Tulsa Oilers, the Waco Wizards. I lived in Waco for like 2 months. What a joke that was.
Well, how so? What was going on there?
Well, it was.
Did you meet David Koresh?
It was after the building went down.
No, you didn't meet him then.
No, I didn't meet him. But I definitely
we should be joking about that.
We shouldn't. But it was nuts. So I drove by it just to see it at the time because it was huge news, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I was there, and then I also played for the Brantford Smoke in the Colonial League for a couple games. And so, like, that's the level that I was playing, and that's after I stopped playing for like 2.5 years. So I was trying to come back and do all that stuff. So finally, after going through the whole circuit of driving all over the place and really just wasting my time,
e-bugging, doing all the other
stuff.
Just trying to latch on with anybody, right?
Anyone, just see what I could do. Just to have peace of mind, because I was not happy with how I approached the whole game. I did that, and then...
What car were you driving at the time, hanging around all these things?
Oh, my God. What did I have? I probably had a Monte Carlo. I think I was driving like a Monte Carlo. back in the day. Yeah.
So you're driving all around Texas and all these other places with Monte Carlo.
Monte Carlo, it was either that or a Tempo. I think the Tempo burnt down in Pittsburgh. So, like, it was probably the Monte Carlo.
So you eventually give up on the dream. Was there a moment where you knew it was over and it was time to go home?
Well, yeah. So, like, I did, and I was like, okay, you know, like, enough's enough. Let me go home. Let me figure this out. I'm still going to coach. You know, I on the way home, I totally snapshot. I think at the end, it was I had to drive from Waco, Texas, all the way back to Buffalo, and I did it in like 3 days and by myself, and it was just an awful experience, you know, like totally dejected, you know. At one point I got so pissed off. I was like between Waco and Dallas.
Early in the trip
I was so mad that I had to pull over because I was feeling like I was going to have road rage and I was going to, like, run someone over, right? So I got out and I pulled over on the side of the road, and I think, what is it? The Highway 35? It goes up north, north and south there. I think it's 35, yeah. Right?
Dallas to Austin,
yep.
Too.
Yeah, right? And I got off on 35 and I pulled my sticks out, my goalie sticks, and I'm smashing them across a rail.
Guardrail
in the middle of 35, and I can only imagine these Southern Texas people looking at it going, what the fuck is this guy doing? He's snapping. So I busted the sticks. I left them there on the road, and then I got back in, and I'm like, I gotta get home.
And then from that point forward,
whatever. So getting back to like how that happened with
American League.
Yeah. American League. So I'm home, and this is still way before cell phones or being able to access people. I'm sitting in my house. I actually just picked up like a mighty pack of Mighty Taco, like six tacos, right?
You're crushing tacos on the couch.
Yeah,
you're definitely
exactly
at a low point. At a low point right now.
Seriously. I walk and my brother walks in and he goes, "Hey, you gotta call Mitch. Rochester just called you up. You gotta go play." And I said, "Shut the fuck up.
What are you talking about?"
And so I walked right by him with my bag of Mighty Taco, and I start going to eat, right? And then he walked back over me saying, "No, I'm serious. Call Mitch." And Mitch says, he's like, "Hey."
They just called you up from what?
Okay,
so, a road rage incident?
Exactly. Like, yeah, like he has no clue.
I'm not even on a team.
I'm like, "I'm done. I'm done. I'm eating Mighty Taco. Leave me alone." So I guess Mike Bales was the goalie at the time in Rochester. He gets hurt. So Mike Bales gets hurt, and Mitch was in South Carolina with Marty Baron, who was part of the program, and they were in the coast. And he was only down there for like a couple days, and they had to call him right back up to play because obviously Bales gets hurt. But they need an emergency goalie. So
who do we call?
Yeah.
Connell.
Yeah,
well,
I got someone. Yeah. Mitch hooked me up, and this is like, "Yeah, we're coming to get you. We'll pick you up. We'll pick you up on the highway, right?"
Did the bus pick you up at a rest stop?
Yes. No joke.
This is the American League.
It's American League. So from Rochester to Buffalo, I think we drove to Toronto and flew from Toronto to Fredericton. But
who was the head coach of Roch at the time?
Oh, my God.
I bet they were happy to see you, whoever you were.
Whatever it was.
Here's our new goalie, the guy from the rest stop. Do we have any sticks for him?
It wasn't Tortorella. Tortorella was already gone at that point.
They had to find you some sticks, though, because the rest of the remnants of yours were sitting on the side of the highway.
Absolutely gone.
Waco, Texas.
Gone. So he says, "Okay, we're going to pick you up at 8 in the morning at exit 50 as soon as you pay the toll in Buffalo." So I have my dad drop me off at the exit, and sure as shit, the bus comes through and pulls over and stops. I grab my gear, I put it underneath the bus, get on the bus, and then the whole team is there. I mean, talk about crickets. 8 in the morning, everyone's like half asleep and they're looking. They're like, "Who the hell is this?" Right?
Right.
So I end up going on the trip, and it was a lot of fun. I was like, I'm not going to play. There's zero chance I'm playing. I'm just going to go and do my thing. So we get to Fredericton, and we have a practice day before we're playing, the day before, and we end go on the ice, and I get on the ice, and I'm playing, and I could tell you that I am so out of shape at this point. I was like, I was so out of it's been at least a month or two.
You've been smashing Mighty Taco
exactly.
For a month.
I'm doing nothing. So
probably a couple crown
get on
oils
the ice,
in the mix,
and my face looked like a friggin' tomato can. It was blowing out of my mask. And I go through that, and I'm like, "Okay, here we go, and we'll play the next night." So we go play the next night, and on the ice is Thomas Vokoun is playing against Marty Baron, and the backups are Jose Theodore and myself. So just like today, you know, I'm at center ice, and I'm stretching with Jose Theodore.
Josie, what's up, buddy?
Yeah, I didn't say a word to him.
No, you didn't
whatever.
Even smack him on the pads.
No,
or anything?
No, nothing.
Man.
No,
I was, that's when you live it up and just play the part.
No, I should have.
Yeah,
I should have.
Because back then they can't like HockeyDB on the internet or anything. You could have just played it off. Like, no, so the next hot shot.
Oh yeah,
right?
Yeah. So, so the game goes and we're winning 1-0, and both goalies are playing great. Marty's playing amazing and hasn't given up anything. It's the second period, and Vokey's playing great. And he ends up, Marty B gets run, and they run him like old school run him. Like they like he ends up out of the blue paint, like on the side of the net, that type of hit. And it looks like a sniper rifle took him out.
He's not moving.
And they look down at me, and I'm like, "Are you fucking kidding me?" So I'm looking out there. So I actually got out on the ice and started to stretch.
What you're doing, like the hamstring stretch?
So I'm
right?
like going, doing the "Oh my stretch. God!" And I mean,
aren't those the worst? Because you know, like whatever you do is not going to prepare you.
Yeah.
But you still got to look like you're at least trying, and that you're trying to warm up, even if it's not going to do it at all. It's just a big charade in the first place, right?
No question.
Yeah. Did you have the backup towel on?
No, I really didn't.
Okay.
And I'm thinking, oh my God, this could go really bad really quick. Really quick. So he's down for about 2-3 minutes, and he ends up getting up, and I'm like, okay, I'm good. I jump on back on the bench, and I'm like, whew.
It's a close one, but I'm good.
Close one, I'm good. We'll see what happens. So in between the second and third, I'm sitting next to Marty, and I say, "Marty, you almost gave me a fucking heart attack." I go, "What were you? How bad were you?" He's like, "I was fine. I was trying to draw a penalty." I go, "You almost fucking killed me."
Funny. You're gonna have to ask him about that.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable. So you backed up 2 games on the weekend
there, and then they called in a guy, and I was supposed to back up. I was just about to get ready to go on the second game, and they flew someone in.
Yeah,
so like
we can't
have this economical guy around anymore.
So
I spent the second night watching the game, and spent the whole trip after that just being a part of the team and having fun and going out, and it was a great experience.
And that was the
it was
end,
fun.
That was the end of your playing career.
Yeah, I totally knew. I was like, okay, thank God I got through that one.
And then you got fired by Mitch 4 times. And how many times do you think you've been fired by Mitch overall?
Oh my God. So, Mitch fired me, so sort of pretend fired okay. me.
Fake fired. Okay.
4 or 5 times.
I mean, you were changing the radio station on him once. That really got him going.
Yeah.
You want to elaborate on that one?
I don't know if I do. Honestly, I'm very, very lucky that my mentor is Mitch Korn. I mean, I would not be doing what I'm doing right now if it weren't for him. So, like, that's the truth. Like, I've learned so much, and I've been able to be around him in the early days. I mean, I still remember the day he got his NHL gig, and I was there. And
well, and you got to help out, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I worked for the Sabres with him.
And your time with the Sabres, too.
Yeah,
right?
So when he started, I was actually probably – I mean, I really didn't get paid. I think I had $20 a game.
Yeah.
But I was one of the first video coaches ever. Before they had videos,
at like
VHS.
20 years old too. Like you were young when you were doing.
Yeah, probably in my early 20s.
Yeah, right.
In that time, and the first 3 years I had this huge, you know, the terrible camcorders.
Oh yeah,
the ones that went over the shoulder
that every grandpa had that they had to hold like a boom box from the.
So my job for like 2-3 years was. To stand in the press box, and every time the power play or the penalty kill went on or a fight happened, I would stand up and I would video it.
The fight was the important part that you
whatever that. That's too, what right? That was yeah. The criteria. That's what I would film.
Of all the things.
That's what I would film. And then I'd bring the tape down, and then the coaches, they would start to watch that stuff. And I think it was Donnie Lever who was the assistant, and he would take that film and he would break down the power play. So the last year, Teddy Nolan was the head coach, and I transitioned from being up in the press box to being in the coaching room, and I was actually doing sort of like what the guys do now with Exos and all the other film, whatever system they use. But this is still VHS, so I'd have a VHS player that was taping the game live, and I'd have this big piece of paper, and I would make timestamps. I'd write down timestamps of when shit happened. I needed to know where it was, timestamp-wise. And then they'd come in between period, and they'd say, hey, Chris, I want to see the first power play, the third power play, and the Rob Ray fight. And I'd have to go look through my list.
Do you think the fights were just for their own entertainment?
No, it was most of the time they wanted to see what was going on, you know, to make sure, you know, suspensions, all that other crap in the day. Because they were maniacs, but...
That's cool. I mean, yeah, think about, like, getting involved in the NHL even at that young of an age, and, I mean, you carry it on through where you at least get a little experience with higher-level stuff like that, right? And... You know, when we
started, absolutely was a great experience. I wouldn't trade that for anything. Being around all those hockey guys and seeing how they worked and how they would coach, it was an amazing thing.
Well, I mean, I think about when I first came to you and we're sitting in your apartment in Buffalo, and Mitch sends me to you, and he goes, "Go train with them. Spend your time there. You can stay there. It'll be easy." Me, Nick Petraglia. We had at least three or four of us. It was basically me and the Miami, Ohio crew were staying in your apartment in Buffalo. You think about the names of guys, though, that came through there in the early years. You know, we haven't really...
There were lots of guys.
Yeah.
And, I mean, one of the things that that kills me to this day is I train so many goalies that I do forget some of them.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And it's not obviously you don't forget the big guys, but I mean, with Mitch's camps, I mean, we would see 300 goalies a summer. So imagine doing that for 10 years and then saying, okay, do I remember who this was?
You don't remember everyone. Think about the web you've cast, you know, like everybody that you've kind of touched along the way, but I mean, you've never been somebody who's really been, you know, too much in self-promoting with this, but I mean, you've worked with some really good goalies along the way here. I mean, when I started, me and Jordan Siglett were with you. Steve Silverthorne came in afterwards, who was another really good goalie. He never really got a crack past ECHL, but
Al Montoya, now a good coach.
And Al Montoya, Marty Turco, Ty Conklin, now Phoenix Copley, Parker Milner. I mean, I'm looking at the wall of pads up there and just who's been through this building. Shane Connolly, NCAA national champion.
Yeah.
I mean, looking back on this, did you ever expect that to happen?
No, I didn't. So the hard part about like starting your own goalie gig or breaking away from Mitch, I never ever wanted to – with Mitch, I never intended on taking his guys – or going into his territory or competing against Mitch ever. So coming to Philly, he wasn't pronounced here. He never ran a camp here. And when I started training Shane, would come to Mitch's camps from Philly, and he said, hey, will you... his mom, Nancy, said, hey, can you come down and train Shane? And he was like a 13-year-old at the time, and he was pretty skilled.
He was way skilled.
He's nasty skilled.
Econ, when I skated with that kid, I thought I was done. I didn't think I could play hockey anymore.
Yeah, it's crazy what he could do.
He could absolutely fly on his skates.
Yeah.
And that's the way all these kids who'd been skating with you were for years. When I got out on the ice, I was like, whoa. If these kids are 13 and 14 and they can move like this, and I'm 20 or 21 or 22, I better catch up in a hurry.
Yeah. So I flew down here like every other month, drove here every other month.
To Philadelphia.
And, to start. Yeah. And then next thing you know, I was coming here every other week. And I was like, oh my, you know, maybe I should just move here and do my thing. And while I was training Shane, Nancy found this rink, and it was just built.
Hockey Heaven, the Hockey mini Heaven. Rink we talked about earlier, right?
Yeah. And when I walked in here, and you walk through the runway on the front door, when I walked in, I said, oh my God, this is where I want to train people. This is perfect. And I had an idea that I wanted to come here. And so I got a couple more clients off of Shane's doing. And next thing you know, I ran a camp. And it was completely jammed at the time. And there was no one around here. So I ended up saying, this is great. I'd love to come down here. And I basically started with nothing and said, screw it, I'm going.
And that's been...
Since 2003.
Time flies, doesn't it, man? Yeah. Now we're sitting in the Goalie Guru office and studio here, but next door is one of the coolest things I've seen. You've got a sheet of ice that's, what, 10 by 10?
It's actually 14 by 11 sheet of ice. It's a sand-based ice rink.
It's up on the second floor. It's right outside your office.
Yeah, so you can see through. It's got a full-fledged mirror on the front, so you can see everything that you do, but it's a see-through on the other side.
So every kid that comes in here that's new to the position, that hasn't learned how to skate, they haven't learned how to properly make safe selections, they've never seen themselves in a mirror before, so they don't know what they're looking at.
Yeah.
That's a huge tool. Oh. I mean, for the young guys, how quickly can you see improvement in their game when you take them up to the little studio there and just work on skating drills?
Well, you can, almost immediately. Because if you just make a few corrections on how they transfer their weight in the first lesson, I mean, now a kid can move laterally. Whereas the kid didn't know any form of fundamental before that. If you just teach a little bit about how to shuffle back and forth, at least he becomes a bubble hockey goalie rather than a statue.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's where we start, and it goes back to, like, you have to skate to play. And that room's perfect. And the room is, you can condition a kid in there, you can teach him muscle memory in there, and you can even talk about theory in there. Right, and show them on the board what's going on. We just put a monitor in there, and now you can actually show, like on Apple TV, we can create or show a play that happened in the NHL, and then say, okay, let's recreate this play in the goalie room, and then they have some idea what they're trying to accomplish as they're doing it. So it's a great thing. The room was crazy proposition at first.
How did you even make that happen? Though,
place? Honestly, it really is.
I mean, that's a total pie in the sky idea.
It is. It was like a mini.
I want to put a sheet of ice on the second floor outside my office. It's 11 by 14.
It was a minor miracle.
Try to sell that.
It really was. So, I got a call from. A kid I played with, Rob Medea, back in the day. He played on my junior team, and his dad called me and said, "Hey, I've got this sheet of ice. I know you're a goalie coach. Do you want to buy it?" So he sent me pictures of it, and it was a compressor with this little pad, and it was a 10 by 10 sheet. And he wanted like $4,000 or $5,000 for it at the time. And I looked at it and I go, oh my God, that's an amazing idea. I'll go up in the storeroom at Hockey Heaven. I'll ask them if I could put it up there and let's see how it goes. So at the time, the owners of the rink, they also own Hatfield Ice, which is a stone's throw from here, also a three-sheet facility. And they built the rink with their main business is heating and cooling. So they built the rink with their own two hands.
Yeah. They got to know how to do all that
stuff.
So
I said to KO, hey, how is this worth buying? Look at this and just tell me. Like, am I stupid if I buy this thing? And he sits down and he looks at it for about 3 minutes and he goes, this is shit. This is shit. I'll build you something that's 10 times better than this. I said, okay. He goes, yeah, well, you just sign the lease and we'll build it upstairs and you can have this, an office and a lobby workout room, whatever you want to turn it into.
And then you got to get a flamethrower.
Yeah, so, right? So like, he actually...
So your flamethrower is how you do the ice in there.
Well, yeah. That's the serious maintenance on the ice.
Okay, yeah.
Like, mostly it's scraping and filling, but every once in a while it gets so uneven that you have to, like, burn it down and then make it even.
I didn't know you could get one of those at Home Depot.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So he ties in the compressor in the back, runs it all the way across the building, up to the second floor, runs it into a sand-based ice rink that he builds himself, and it's a sheet of ice that is in there 24/7. That is unbelievable. That the ice in the goalie room is probably better than any sheet you could.
It's pretty hard.
It's hard as can be.
Yeah.
And it's even like we'll put like 6 to 8 guys on the ice a night, and even though that amount of kids will beat the crap out of it, it still holds. It's very rare that we go all the way down to nothing, but. Depends how old the guys are, too.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've had all age groups. I mean, what really separates the elite from the kids who you're thinking might have a good high school career, let's say? Can you tell at a young age when somebody really has it?
Yes, absolutely. There's definitely a formula. I mean, obviously size matters. And do they have a chance to be bigger now? Because everyone can skate. Like, whether you're small or you're big, everyone... Eventually, if you do the right things, you will have the skill set to play, right? So that matters. And then you have the skating component, which if you work hard at your skating and you can establish position and arrive early on most things, that gives you a huge advantage. And then from there, you take a look at like puck stopping. And I take it for granted now that like kids can catch the puck, and I did for a while. I really didn't train like enough to hey, okay, let's work on catching the puck, because I took it for granted. It was like skating, make saves, get down, and that's the most important thing. Well, you have to be able to control the puck, and what separates the great goalies from the average guys is your ability to control it. It's not good enough to just make saves. You gotta control it. And then you have to have the ability to make a secondary save in control. So save, movement, save. And that's the combination. And then the third one, if you want to blow yourself up and you make that save, then you're on ESPN, right?
Right.
But
hopefully
two saves.
Have to get there. Yeah.
Because you're not going to control every puck that the guy throws the puck into your pads down low, or he's on a bad angle and he throws it into your feet. You're going to have to find a way to fight it off and then find a way to get to the next location and make yourself big and then stop the puck.
What drives you crazy as a coach?
As a coach? Lots of things. I don't even know what would drive me the most crazy.
Not having coffee's got to be one.
Well,
of them.
Coffee gets me through the day. Thank you, Wawa.
Yeah,
for being in Philly.
20 ounces of straight black coffee from Wawa, right?
Mm-hmm. The group of goalies that we have here, we're definitely like a family. Either you're in or you're out, and if you're in, everyone is part of our crew. and it's almost like big brother, little brother. Everyone helps everyone, right? So the guys who are in here have to do a good job making sure that everyone is on board in terms of getting better when they go out there.
Group thing.
So, like, if you're just coming here to come here because your parents sent you, you don't last very long and you need to go.
Flip like, side of that, when you get the pro guys in here, they're the high-level college guys.
Yeah.
What excites you about having them in the building?
So, it's knowing that you the skill level that the guys possess now is absolutely crazy when they come here. And like the fine-tuning aspect of grabbing a guy, because you're not going to change. Like the one thing that I would try to say about me as a goalie coach is that I am not a robot guy. I would not say, okay, you got to play this way no matter what. Like everyone's different. Guys who are bigger, you have to treat them a little bit differently, and they have to play in a different way to get the same thing accomplished. But the philosophy is similar in that you have to find a way to make the combination saves. So they still have to save, and then they move differently to get where they're going. Right? So it's just a little different. But I appreciate the skill of the guys that have already trained or been in different places that come here and train.
What's the compete level like on those guys?
For the most
part, I've seen some different ones over the years, too, right? Like give you a great example. Like when Seamus Cotter came in here, great goaltender.
Yeah.
He had a good career, but he was very.
And a great coach now. We have to give him props for that.
But Seamus was very meticulous in how he did things. He wanted to build up to it. And then when it was time to turn it on, he'd turn it on, you know? But I feel like we all have had kind of different times when we'll turn it on.
Mm-hmm.
But once the compete level finally kicked in, it was go time.
Yeah.
You know, is that...
Yeah, and I don't really believe in the gamer thing. I believe in the gamer... I believe in the gamer theory, like, in terms of an all-around goaltending mentality. Like, you either stop the puck or you don't. Like, you could be a good... I have guys that I call great puck stoppers. They find a way to stop the puck. It's not the guys who stop the puck in games and are they call themselves gamers find a way to stop the pucks in practice also. So you can't be lackadaisical in practice and not think that it's going to affect the game.
You must have had a couple moments out on this rink, though, that have been pretty funny over the years. Pucks flying by your ears and near misses.
Oh, I've been crushed a couple times. Like, I've actually thought about wearing a helmet.
A half shield, really?
No, for real. Yeah. So last year, and knock on wood, I have not been hit this year. But last year, I got hit in the face with the puck. And it hit me right in the eye. And I was talking to a kid. I was actually giving to him. I was on the half wall. I'm pissed off. And all of a sudden, I hear ting. It comes right off the crossbar. And I turn a look. And I look out of the side of my eye. And next thing I know, this thing's coming. And I tried to get out of the way. And it just smacks me flat right in the face. It was awful. Really? But I've been hit like 3 or 4 times down in this rink. And the problem is, if you get pro shooters down there or guys who can shoot the puck with any velocity, it is like a pinball machine out there. I mean, it comes off that you can make a save with pro guys out there and off the pad, it'll hit the half wall and be right back out in the slot in 1 second.
Not even.
Yeah, not
tenth
even.
Tenth of a second. Yeah, man, it happens for real. So fast in here. Yeah.
For real.
What have been some of the prouder moments for you over the years?
Oh, I mean, it'd be way too difficult to even pick out one.
Right.
But I could definitely say I'm very proud of every goalie that comes here. I mean, I take pride in going to seeing guys play. And then any form of excellence puts a smile on my face.
Seeing them enjoy the game, too.
Yeah, right? Again, I could care less how skilled you are. I care more about, like, for the kids that come here, I care about, like, are they trying to get better? And then it works out, right? Again, not every kid is going to be an NHL goalie. So, but every kid can learn to be disciplined and the way that they train, and at least take what they do, take their craft serious, and say, this, I want to be good at this. And then they figure out a way to do it. So that actually, when someone like and I'll give you one example, Jordan Fromm, who played at Penn, University of Penn, hit club hockey. I never ever, like when he trained, I mean, he never thought he would play D1 hockey. And then even to the point, like he played tier 2 hockey and then ended up being the guy there and had an amazing career. And he graduated from Penn. He's graduating from Penn this year. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. And I watched him play, and that's the kind of thing that I'd rather see that than even the NHL. I mean, these guys will be friends for life.
I mean, when it comes down to it, I'm sure you just want to see everybody get the most out of the game that they possibly can. And whether that's juniors, whether that's club-level hockey, Division I, Division III, you're still playing with meaning for it, you know, and you want to go as far as you can and enjoy it as long as you can. And I've had a lot of friends like that have just told me how great it was to be able to play until they were 22, you know. Yeah. And because nothing's like it once you get to the beer league, which Kane Van Gade will tell people. Yeah. That all roads lead to BHL.
Yeah,
it's just different, you know. It's not the same as playing for your school or your junior team or your city or anything like that.
No, I mean, I tell this to people all the time. I would give my left testicle to play in a game that actually meant something. I'm serious. Yeah. I would love to play in a game that where you actually it meant that, like, you had that feeling of playing and said, "Oh my God, I got this on the line." Going playing in the beer league is fun, and playing with your friends is fun, but the guys who play, you don't realize that until after it's over.
For me,
yeah,
the last 2 years playing in the Calder Cup Finals was the ultimate because it was everything on the line at the second highest stage, short of the Stanley Cup Finals. Yeah. I mean, but man, you get to Game 7,
yeah,
playing for something like that, a championship.
It means something.
With and your friends, and it is written down for the rest of eternity that you've done this. You will forever be a winner. And, you know, as much as it sucked to lose those two games and to lose those two series, there was still a big sense of accomplishment getting there and playing on that stage and just even knowing what it's like. Yeah. Because unless you've done it, you don't know. Game 7, final series, everything on the line.
Yeah,
it you can't describe that to people what that's like, you mm-hmm. know, and you're not going to get that in the BHL.
Yeah.
It's just a different feeling.
Not going to happen.
No. So what's the future of goaltending here? Where do you see the game moving in the next 5-10 years on down the road?
So there's been a shift in about 10 to 15 years ago, I thought, like, the goaltending was on the rise, and the goals against and the save percentage, it was going in the favor of the goalies. Now it's really gone in favor of the forwards, based on the technology of the sticks, based on guys skating and the way that they play and the way they make the goalies move east-west, right?
Their skill training.
Skill, right. Big time. So they're moving the puck nonstop. It's almost, like, NHL has gone, it looks more shinny than it ever has, right? Because the game, the way they changed the rules, you can't hook, you can't grab, you can't interfere the way you used to.
They finally figured out now that you don't have to look like a linebacker on skates to be effective. And they're prioritizing skill over the other stuff, which is the way it should be when you're trying to score goals, right? Mm-hmm. It's changed everything.
So I find now that the goalies are starting to learn that they're looking at the situations that are in front of them in a different way now, and they're trying to stay on their blades longer and trying to establish positions. So it's going back to skating, and if you can get your body in front of it, even though it's going back and forth, if you can stay on your blades longer, you're gonna make more saves. The sliding scenario, if you're throwing your body around aimlessly and not looking then going, you're in trouble. You got to look and go. If you throw your body across without any purpose, you're fucked. And that's the bottom line. I mean, it really is. So imagine, like, I'll tell a lot of guys, I don't care how you stop the puck in the game. Like, obviously, when you train here, I want you to move, like I'll have a goalie make a save, slide, push, pull, and come across in perfect technique. In a game, I don't care how you stop the puck. If you're tracking it and for some reason your eyes tell you that you have to blow yourself up to make a save, so be it. So tracking is the only thing that will take a goalie and make them more consistent. The more consistent you are with tracking locations, the more consistent you'll be in stopping pucks. Because I think a lot of goalies lose focus, or they'll arrive late on passes. You have to arrive early. And that doesn't mean you're going to get there with before the pass. Like, you might be late on it, but you're trying to arrive early. And if you're trying to do that, at least you can look and evaluate what that shooter is going to do next. So if he's going to shoot it or not, like, he could shoot it or pass it. And if you can decide what or make a good guesstimate of what you think that guy's going to do, that gives you the ability to make a better decision. And that better decision adds to your numbers, 100%.
Stay on your edges.
Yeah.
Beat the pass.
Mm-hmm.
Get your eyes on the puck.
Yeah.
Be in control.
Yeah.
It's easy, and, right? Yeah. Why can't everybody do this?
It's a simple position.
It's such a misnomer, man. Yeah. It's so complicated, and guys are much more skilled than they've ever been.
Yeah, it's amazing. It really is. And I'm a huge hockey fan. I'm not a goaltending fan. I'm a huge hockey fan. I love watching hockey, and I love the whole systematic part of the game, from power play to penalty kill to neutral zone to how you defend in your own end. I really do. I love it. And the game, you watch the things that these guys are able to do now, and it's amazing. I can only imagine what it's going to be like 10 years from now.
When I'm long gone from the game.
Yeah.
Yep. As good as these guys are getting at it, man, it'll be my time by then. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I can't wait to see where it goes, because right now you watch this game, and I've seen it over the course of my career, how much it's changed and how dynamic you have to be now. And it's always been a fight to stay ahead of the curve, stay up with what everybody's doing, and that's what we've been working on all these years, right?
Yeah.
So much fun talking about your past with this stuff. We're going to have part two, part three, part four.
Yeah.
And, of course, the farewell econ tour that will only be released.
Upon my death?
Upon your death.
That'll be great. Yeah.
So thanks so much for joining me. It was a pleasure.
Thanks, Mike.
Chris Economo, everybody.